You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
We're spending the day talking about leapfrogging. We're talking about going over obstacles, past obstacles, around obstacles. And I want to do a little activity right now that's going to focus us on taking obstacles, what we think of as barriers, and turning them into opportunities. Because if we're really going to jump forward in education towards big solutions to big problems, we have to be incredibly creative in our thinking. So at Center for Inspired Teaching, we base our teacher training on improvisational theater. And this is an improvisational theater activity. I'm going to ask my friend Adam to come help me. Come on up, Adam. My own kids love this activity, and they are really, really good at it. And I will tell you that one of the founders of improvisational theater, a man named Keith Johnstone, says that adults are atrophied children. I would like to challenge you today, right now, to prove him wrong. So in a minute, I'm going to ask you all to find a partner sitting next to you or near you or a couple of partners. Please find somebody who speaks the same language as you do to make this easier. And for those of you watching along on the webcast or in the overflow rooms, you can do this with a partner if you have one, or you can give yourself some challenges, be as creative as you'd like. So this is how it goes. And once I turn this over to you, this is what you're going to do with your partner. One of you is going to be climbing a mountain. Adam is climbing a mountain. Adam, I see you're climbing a mountain.
Indeed I am.
Here is a lightning storm for you as a gift.
Thank you so much, Jane, for the lightning storm. I am going to take a lightning rod, use the storm's energy to power my cell phone, and then use the cell phone to call for a helicopter to take me up the mountain.
Excellent, excellent.
Thank you. So I see you're also climbing a mountain.
I am.
Wonderful. So I am going to gift you a pack of ferocious wolves.
Thank you.
Of course.
For this pack of wolves. I am going to take the pack of wolves and I am going to send them to attack the bears that have been eating all my food so that I can have my food and make it up the mountain. Okay. So that's how it goes. You are going to take turns giving each other presents. Your partner is climbing a mountain. You give them a present that is not at all helpful and maybe downright unhelpful. And their job is to take that gift and turn it into something they can use to help them climb the mountain. Go. You both have had a turn.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's my body.
everyone can come back. Back down the mountain. Back to our room. Back to Monday afternoon. Back to post-lunch. Back to our paddle. Back to your seats. I am. Okay, we're going to get started with our paddle this afternoon. Thank you. I was an elementary school teacher for a long time, so I may have to pull out the elementary school teacher tricks. But that seems to have worked, yes. We've got the hand claps. So I hope all of you have come back from lunch ready to face any obstacle in education and beyond and turn it into an opportunity. And I know that's something that the next panel will be talking about a little bit, so I'm going to bring Rebecca back up here to introduce them.
Yes, for sure. Give Jane a round of applause, just for keeping us awake at a bare minimum. Nevertheless, inspiring us to overcome obstacles. I am really happy to welcome you all back post-lunchtime for this session on teacher training and teacher development. I'm going to introduce two people. The first is our featured speaker, Professor Juho Lee, who will come up and share some of his insights and experiences when he was Minister of Education of South Korea. You have his full bio, in your pack. He is also one of the education commissioners of the International Education Commission. He's also chairing the Education Workforce Initiative that had a whole consultation and discussion at lunchtime. And so many reasons to welcome Juho to the Brookings stage. And then after Juho speaks for a little bit, he will step off the stage and Jenny Anderson will come and moderate a panel discussion. Jenny, you also have her bio along with all the panelists in your packet, is a wonderful education journalist from Quartz, The Atlantic, and we're very lucky to have you, Jenny. So Professor Lee, welcome to the stage.
Thank you, Rebecca, for your nice introduction. I'm very honored to talk about leapfrog in education workforce based on South Korea's experience and more recent work by Education Workforce Initiative. South Korea achieved very rapid and sustained economic growth, and now its GDP per capita GDP reached to $30,000 U.S. dollars. So this great achievement, of course, is mainly due to its investment in people. So the engine of growth was definitely human capital, in other words, education. So when you look at the right-hand side, you can see that Korea has universalized basic education within just one generation after its independence. So you can see that the enrollment rate at the elementary level reached to 100% in early 1960, despite that Korea had a war in early 1950s. And the second the line, which is about the enrollment rate in lower secondary level, reached to the universal level in 1980. So after its independence in 1945, it takes only 35 years, just one generation, to attain universal basic education. And afterwards, Korea has one of the highest enrollment rate in higher education in the world. So this very rapid increase in enrollment rates, noted by Education Commission as progressive universalism, has been really the key factor contributing to the economic growth, sustained economic growth. And above all, teachers were at the heart of this remarkable process. You probably know that Korean students ranks in at the top in PISA test. And the PISA test in 2015 asked the students very interesting questions, whether they want to become, aspire to become teachers. And you can see Korea is outstandingly number one with a big margin with the second. So when you are asking Korean students what kind of jobs they are taking after schools, the teacher comes first, even before lawyers, lawyers and doctors. So so that's the one of the success element that lies behind those rapid economic growth and education development. So South Korea leapfrogged in third industrial revolution, which is often called digital revolution. So leapfrog, the word leapfrog is very familiar in South Korea. you can see that all the mobile phones and TVs are all produced by famous Korean companies. But Korea is now facing daunting challenges in fourth industrial revolution. You know that throughout this leapfrogging in third industrial revolution, teachers played key roles, but teachers are now also having a lot of problems. Because you see that Korean students are not happy, and also Korean teachers are losing self-efficacy. You know that Korean teachers are best paid, and the best students became teachers, and teachers are respected by all people, but they are losing their self-efficacy because their pedagogies are outdated. The students are losing interest, and they are not paying attention to teachers. The lecture provided by teachers uniformly to every student in the classroom does not make students interested. So this so-called mass production system, you know, the mass production system is often used word in describing the second industrial revolution. But this is also very closely related to the way we teach students in the classroom. Right? Without big transformation from mass production to mass personalization in education, I don't think we can address the challenges posed by fourth industrial revolution in education. So many policymakers in Korea is now talking about radical change, big transformation in education from mass production to mass personalization. So from learn to test to learn, from shallow learning based on rote memorization to deep learning, from vertical learning based on lectures to horizontal learning where teachers are playing a role like a coach while students are doing projects with their peer students. So when we are discussing the ways to transform whole education system, I personally think that teacher education and training system is the key. how we can harness education technology and learning science to teach teachers so that they can actually teach so-called high-touch, high-tech learning is the key. You know that this is the model of Arizona State University, and I heard from ASU that more than 65,000 students already benefited from the adaptive learning system, where artificial intelligence and big data can help students to have all the different learning paths within the same classroom. So this turned out to be very effective in increasing the ability to understand and to remember. But this does not, artificial intelligence does not replace teachers, because teachers can focus more on high-touch learning in the area of creating, evaluating, analyzing, and applying. So this is really interesting model of combining high-tech with high-touch learning. So this is quite a specific model, but I think it can be extended to apply to K-12. And why not we can start adopting this model to teaching teachers? This is one example how we can radically change our system, education system, from mass production to a personalized learning system. So Korea now became a donor country in 2009, and we are discussing how we can help other developing countries. And we know that Korea benefit enormously from Peabody Project, because we have a huge knowledge transfer from Western countries, including USA, and we have many educators, experts, learned from Western tradition and Western ways of teaching through this kind of knowledge transfer projects. Then when we are able to help other developing countries, do we have to do the same thing? That's our concern. We know that although we did a big success, but our model doesn't work anymore in the new era. So maybe it's time for Korea to work together with developing countries to leapfrog, rather than suggest them to follow so-called Korean model. So this is what I understand about leapfrogging strategy. So maybe this tells why I'm working with now Education Workforce Initiative, because you know that even Korea, who successfully leapfrogged in the third industrial revolution era, now facing a daunting challenge posed by fourth industrial revolution. So I don't think any country holds the best model for education workforce right now. We all have to figure out how we can overcome this challenge. So, but it is not really easy to make a transformation at the national level, especially in the area of education workforce, teachers. I have my own experience as a minister. I have done a lot of changes in education area, except for teacher area. It's really hard, politically difficult. So then why not we collectively work together at the international community level? I think it's really high time for international community to join forces to focus on change in radical change in teachers, harnessing and embracing education technologies and learning science. So that's how Education Workforce Initiative was set up. And we are going to produce two important outcomes First one is education workforce report that will be published next year, early next year. And we really want to get new ideas, different approaches to design and strengthen education workforce. And second, EWI is doing a series of country-specific proposals of education workforce reform. So we are working with now three countries, including Ghana, Sierra Leone, and Vietnam. I'm going to ASU right after this seminar to talk about how we can help Vietnam to introduce ASU model to teach their teachers. If Vietnam can be successful in introducing ASU model, maybe Vietnam can leapfrog, even Korea. So that's how we aim at radical changes in developing countries. Maybe Vietnam alone cannot make that kind of bold change, but if international community like EWI and also working with ASU and other partners help a country like Vietnam to make a radical change in education workforce, maybe they can make a difference. Thank you very much for your attention.
So I'm super excited for this panel. We have an incredible amount of talent and experience up here. I don't want to talk for very long because their experience is what you are here to hear about. I just want to briefly mention last Friday, some somewhat alarming and probably not surprising to anybody in this room, data came out with respect to teacher leaving rates in the United States. They have been rising every year for the past 3 years. They were about 5.1% in 1992, and now they are more than double that. And in high-need schools, it's double that rate as well. As we were leaving the panel earlier this morning, a former UK education minister said to me, the situation in the UK is catastrophic, the rate at which teachers are leaving. So I think we all know we're not doing a good enough job of making this a rewarding and engaging and a professionalized career for them. The solution to that attrition is in, I think, the bulk of what we're going to be talking about today is this professional development and how we can do it better. Vicky mentioned to me that we spend $16.8 billion just in the United States on this, and basically teachers don't like what they're getting. So I think we can definitely improve on that. Rebecca also noted this morning that of all of their 3,000 innovations they looked at, a whopping 9% focused on helping teachers get towards a breadth of skills, you know, getting them the breadth of skills they need to get their students a breadth of skills. That's what we're here talking about, right? Students need a breadth of skills, a breadth of competencies, a breadth of mindsets to succeed. Well, how are we going to get that to them? Teachers. I don't think anyone in this room is going to dispute that it's the teachers that's the primary motor of change here that we need to focus on. So that's what we want to unpack here. What are the obstacles to getting better professional development, and what are some solutions? We want to go as deep as we can and in as short a time as we can on some examples we have right here as to what's working and also what hasn't worked and why, so we understand that better so we can create more effective solutions. I'm going to let the panel introduce themselves. They'll do a better job than I will, and then we'll dive right in.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Mary Catherine Ricker, and I am a National Board Certified Middle School English Teacher by license in the state of Minnesota, and I am currently Executive Vice President of the American Federation of Teachers by election. It's great to be here. Thank you.
I'm going to just stop for 1 second because Vishal gave me the best idea before we started. So I'm going to steal his idea.
Yes.
Tell me why you do what you do. And
yes.
Each of you, if you could just say why you do what you do, that would be helpful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So folks in the teaching profession in general, like some other professions, medicine, for example, social work, et cetera, usually, like me, they're looking for a job where you can take your skills and leave the world a little better than the way you found it at the same time. And that's why I went into teaching. And while I was a classroom teacher, I realized that I had an additional interest in leaving my profession a little bit better than the way I found it as well. And so that's when I began to use my union activism to do just that. So that's why I do the work I do.
Michelle?
Lovely. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Really great to be here. I am the co-founder of a nonprofit based out of India called Dream a Dream. And we work with young people and teachers, helping young people overcome adversity and to thrive in the 21st century. We use a creative life skills approach to do that. Why do I do what I do? I'll tell you a recent story. Recently, we had a trainer who joined us, a trainer who helps us train teachers. She comes from a rural village. She grew up in a large family. She accomplished a lot herself. She became a principal of a local school. She runs 5 community computer centers to teach children computers. She's also on the board of a local committee that overlooks development in the neighborhood. Yet when she came to us, she had this very low self-esteem and sense of self. I mean, here is someone who's highly accomplished. And through the course of the training, we realized that every time she went, she tried to do something, tried to overreach or be ambitious or be aspirational, there's a small voice at the back of her head, which was the voice of her father who kept telling her she's not good enough, that she grew up with every day. And even though she was selected to be a trainer and not a husband who was also well accomplished in his own right, they couldn't believe it. How come she got selected? So one of the reasons why I do what I do is because I believe deeply in the concept of dignity. And I think one of the big pieces of work we need to invest in is bring dignity back to the role of the teacher, bring dignity back to the teacher. Thank you.
Thank you. Vicki?
I'm Vicki Phillips. I'm currently serving as the CEO in residence for EduCurious. I'm a former superintendent 2 times, a former, what you might think of as a state minister in this country, a state chief of basic and higher ed. I spent nearly a decade at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation as their director of education. And I would say there's 2 reasons why I do this work. One, because I am just a passionate believer that there's something magical about that learning bond between kids and teachers, and that we should give that bond all the power that we possibly can. And 2, because I'm a first-generation college student myself. I'm a poor kid who got a lucky break, and I actually believe that all kids should have that opportunity by design.
Amen.
Thank you. Juho?
Yeah, why I do what I do? Basically, I'm trained as an economist, and also in academia now, I'm coming back to academia and publishing papers in economic journal. But I really enthusiastic in changing education because I believe in the fact that education is the engine of growth and also the powerful equalizer. Rebecca talked about skill inequality, I think this is the really big challenge that all the countries are facing, and education is the most effective tool to reduce inequality.
You and your presentation before really showed us just what can happen when you actually embrace this, when you make it a national priority, when you empower it. Yeah. We need to maybe do it differently this time around, but it must be particularly powerful having lived the example, that you've seen it, you've seen the evidence. You don't need to be convinced by a textbook. I want to start briefly, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I do think Rebecca and I were talking about this when I read the report and I was writing about it. I said, why are there so few? Why is that 9% number 9%? I don't get it. You know, if we all believe in teachers and we believe that teachers are the sort of path to change, why are so few education innovations focused on teacher development, on professional development towards a breadth of skills? So I'd love for you all to answer that. I'm going to pick on Mary Catherine first.
Absolutely.
Why so low?
I'm going to focus on a couple answers and then probably add answers as our time goes on. I'm going to start with the idea that we actually are still treating professional development as an add-on to a teacher's experiences. And those places where it has worked, I would venture a guess that you likely have found professional development where they are treating it as a part of a teacher's working conditions, not as the 3 extra days tacked on to the end of the school year, not as the extra hour every Tuesday after school, not as an add-on, right? Like, we're hiring you to be a teacher. Oh, and by the way, from time to time, you'll have to do professional development, right? The verb that is always used is you have to do professional development. And so I do believe that is one of the shifts. And we, right, royal we, have shaped a profession that says professional development is something extra, not part of your legitimate working conditions. And so I do think that is one barrier. Is like, as soon as we name it, we can start figuring out how to break it down. I also think the second shift that needs to be made is that historically, teachers have also been managed. And, we have infantilized teaching both in that sort of soft focus worldview, like, oh, we love teachers. And in that professional view of they must be managed, teachers do not have the capability of making decisions for ourselves. And so there is a shift that has to be made, because as soon as we start treating teaching as a career of professionals who have the intellectual capability of making decisions for ourselves and shaping those working conditions and things, Then we have shifted from managing teachers to a career where you actually are shaping the profession yourself. And there are some reasons we have historically not put decision making in teachers' hands. And those reasons are all fairly outdated. They were actually probably fairly biased when we made them, actually. And there is actually, historically, you can see, fight after fight after fight in keeping decision-making from teachers' hands, whether that is fighting the right of teachers to organize and form a collective voice in a union, or whether that is the current way of doing that is teacher-proofing material, right? Like having your shrink-wrapped curriculum delivered to you and told you can break the seal at September 1st at 8:05, right? Like, there are ways we have been managed as opposed to creating the sort of career that I think would also get at the attrition point you made, right? Creating the sort of career where the decision-making shifts to classroom professionals. Right.
And this is something you see when you travel around the world, and in a place like Finland or in Singapore, what you see is a huge amount of agency. The teachers mm-hmm. have agency. They're very well trained, but they're also very well trusted. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of what you're getting at.
Absolutely.
Vishal, can you take a stab at that from the context of India? Why so hard to do effective professional development and make it a priority and get it done at scale?
Yeah, from the Indian context, I think it's a bit more complex. I think one is there are certain structural challenges. If I just put some data out there, between 1960 to 1993, we moved from 1,200 teacher education institutes to about 1,500 teacher education institutes. But in 1993, we set up the National Commission on Teacher Education, National Council on Teacher Education. And since then, till about 2011, we set up 16,000 teacher education institutes, 90% of them private. And data that's coming out now, which is saying, is that 75% of them don't even have a program. They're fake. Mm. So they just give out certificates.
Right.
Okay. So it's become more business than actually an investment in education.
Mm-hmm.
So there's structural challenges. Second is, of course, India is huge, right? I mean, there's a requirement of nearly 12 million teachers in the country, right? There are 12 million teachers in the country. So you just need more hands, right? And to train such a large population, is going to take
right.
its own complexity.
Yeah.
However, I think those are still systemic challenges that can be addressed. I think a bigger challenge that we are not addressing, and which is probably even contextual across the world, is our own mindsets around teachers. Our mindset around teachers, I think, in the last 3 or 4 decades has shifted from someone that we looked up to someone now we look down upon. And I think it's really, for me, it's a reflection of, can I look within myself and can I really trust a teacher? Can I really give agency back to the teacher? Can I really give decision-making power back to the teacher? Am I creating the enabling environments in my policy frameworks, in my implementation, in my professional development to help the teacher feel that they own this? They own their classroom of 40 or 60 kids. I think that's where we are failing.
Right.
Yeah.
Ricky? Outstanding.
Well, I think that nearly everything that we know works, which is a lot of what you've just said, making it personalized, putting, you know, it in content and context, having teachers learn at a lot of their own pace, going from just minimal improvement to really deep sophistication and mastery your craft, making sure that it's by teachers for teachers, that they are actually the designers, the collaborators, the coaches, the calibrators, all those things that we know work are things that we just haven't done, right? We've done them so little. And so I think it feels like a really big, overwhelming task in many ways to try to change every aspect of that. It's one issue. The second is I think we have really failed to create the kind of enabling conditions for all of this to happen. Still lack of time, particularly in this country, for teachers to really come together and collaborate, to be joined by a larger network of teachers out there that they can reach out to and helps reduce that sense of isolation and that they can share ideas and problem solve and find solutions with. And then the third thing I would say is that we haven't yet figured out how to embrace, harness, however you want to frame it, tech-enabled solutions so that we can get the best of face-to-face with technology that can actually help that kind of personalized learning for teachers that we actually want for students also to be viable.
So in making a good teacher policy, it takes a long-term commitment by government and by teacher unions and many other players. But government changes every 5 years.
Are you saying politicians aren't long-term thinkers?
There's hope, yeah.
I thought that was just in the U.S.
So that's the problem. I mean, so because of this problem, I think it's time to consider the role of international community, really focusing on teacher issues. Mm-hmm. When we are providing aid to developing countries, we can focus on teachers. Teacher development above any other area, so that we can think about ecosystem of making a change in teachers, and the void is there because we really need a long-term commitment of major player, and maybe this is the role of international community with long-term commitment, and we can make a kind of a consensus building through international community, because it's quite difficult at the national level to make a compromise between teacher union and minister, because we have a lot of issues to fight. Right? So the at the international level, when you think about long-term changes, we can make a good consensus between important players, Education International and UN and other leaders can join together to have a kind of project to make a change in teachers.
We have to make it cool internationally to be investing in teachers and to be rethinking this and rethinking this in a really broad way. A conversation in Davos that was very interesting this year, very much talking about automation and the fallout from automation and how are we going to reskill our workers. It was just sort of an amazing kind of deficit of understanding that perhaps we could better skill them in the first place, and education is a tool for that. And I kept asking these great business titans and government leaders, like, what about education? Oh, yeah, education's really important. Nobody had a plan, you know? And so I do think that mindset shift is incredibly important. All right, let's get into the meat of the what, of what we see. I'd love to maybe pose to you all hope and despair. What do you see that gives you hope? And what do we need to fix, or but let's focus on the sort of solutions that are working. And Vicky, I'd love to start with you and go back to your technology piece. We talk a lot about technology, personalized for students, adaptive technology for students to get better scores, to get broader skills. Can we do this for teachers, and how? What does that look like?
Well, you know, one of the privileges I have at the moment is helping a couple of EdTech startups, and one of which is EduCurious, which is a great example of your high-touch, high-tech sort of criteria earlier. And I should say that in the audience is actually the founder and most recent CEO of EduCurious, Michael Golden. I'm just getting to sort of continue to nurture EduCurious along. But EduCurious is an example of both the student and the teacher facing side in that it is all focused on project-based learning so that teachers use project-based curriculum in science, social studies, and English language arts with all of those contemporary career-connected skills we'd like built in to engage students deeply in projects and authentic questions that matter to them, connected to a set of experts that allow those students to connect with other adults virtually, to see people in other careers that they might not have aspired to. And teachers then get that same experience. They get to develop their muscle, if you will, their sophistication in project-based learning over a period of time. They then learn how to adopt or how to adapt and then how to innovate against that. And that level of professional development and support over a sustained period of time seems to have teachers having more efficacy, students having more agency, and classrooms being a much more engaged, happy, and vibrant place. So it's a good example of what happens when you use technology as not the sole driver, but as a great enabler of good curriculum and professional learning. And the professional learning is obviously a continuing combination of face-to-face as well as virtual.
But also...
So about the project-based learning, I really wanted to encourage Korean teachers to adopt project-based learning. But the most frequent heard response from teachers is that they have to teach students on subjects. So how they can find time to do project with students. But if we can introduce adaptive learning technologies, artificial intelligence robots or big data can help teachers to reduce the burden for teaching subjects, and they can focus more on project-based learning, right?
So we're going to have robots doing math and then teachers doing projects?
Maybe in the future. The thing
about project-based learning is that it doesn't have to be devoid of the discipline. So what EduCurious does is craft full-on units that then get added up into courses in biology, for example, or science, working on it now, 6th to 8th grade, or social studies, a Project America course, for example. So teachers do not have to sacrifice their discipline and their subject area for project-based learning. And projects don't just mean wait till the end of the year and do something cumulative. It means kids get to really interact with interesting questions and projects along the way. And all of those contemporary skills that we want kids to learn, like communication and collaboration and critical thinking, can be built into those projects and opportunities. And so that, you know, kids and teachers both get that kind of deep, engaged experience you were hoping for earlier.
And no thoughtful teacher is actually going to trust a spreadsheet saying that some basics have been met. They're going to want to see it and feel it and witness it themselves to make those projects that much stronger and that much more personalized, quite frankly.
That's right. And they can, because they can learn how to do project-based learning well, and then they can adapt and modify it into other subjects, into other areas of interest, into other questions that they think are really important to them.
And just to bring it back, this is a bottom-up, not a top-down approach. So I think that's, as we talk about this, let's make sure we kind of reference how much of this is the international community talking about this and making it important and a priority, national governments setting standards, assessments, you know, whatever that, and then this social, I think someone earlier referred to it as a social movement, the bottom-up. So which of those are most effective? Vishal, let me throw it to you right now, because yours is very much bottom-up, right? This is about empowering people.
Right.
Can that work at scale? How will that work?
So I think we're sitting on a more fundamental question here, and I kind of want to push back my co-panelists a bit here. I think I go back to the earlier question of what is the purpose of education. And I think it's very easy to get stuck in the hows, and there are enough solutions of the how available in the world today, you know, with artificial intelligence, mobiles. I know in India, even with our complications with education, we are able to bring in a lot of technology-based solutions in education. The entrepreneurs in the information technology field are really bringing in cutting-edge solutions using technology, but they're failing. I mean, you know, the recent research of Khan Academy, for example, being introduced in India, you know, with big fanfare, the results were that while everyone's signing up for the Khan Academy programs, each kid is actually spending less than 8 minutes on it. So again, the question comes to what's not working? Right? Why are these solutions not working? And I'll bring in two lenses, which are my lenses of despair. One is that education is a political subject. We have to acknowledge it. And unless we bring in political buy-in and political will into transforming education, we will get stuck in these five-year election cycles. Right? Education is not even a subject by which political parties fight elections in India. It's mm-hmm. not even talked about. So we have mm-hmm. to accept that, acknowledge that, and make it a political subject. The second lens, which I believe a lot of the West is struggling with, but these are real lenses in countries like India or parts of Africa, is that 48 million children in India under the age of 5 are stunted. And the next big country is Nigeria with 10 million children. Now, that's a big challenge. It's a complex challenge in India. It's overwhelming almost. Right? How do you address a challenge where 48 mm-hmm. million children are not even able to access the education you're bringing to them because they mm-hmm. don't have the skills to access it?
Right.
And by access, I mean that they don't have the capacities to actually access how to learn mathematics or how to learn a language because they're growing up in adversity.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, unless we acknowledge again that lens that there are children growing up in adversity and we have to help them catch up to their developmental milestones.
Right.
We can keep talking about education strategies and how of it. None of these strategies are going to work with children growing up in adversity. However, I'm going to close on a hope.
That's okay. However, our panel is exactly on the teachers, so tell us how we're going to empower the teachers.
Yeah, so it's important that we see that there is light at the end of the tunnel. In our own experience of 18 years of having worked now and with about 6,000 odd teachers that we've worked with in India, the good news is teachers in rural communities, semi-urban communities, urban communities, young people who are growing up in adversity have already recognized that the world is changing, that the world is becoming increasingly complex and uncertain. They are adapting. Our teachers are adapting with all these complications and boundaries and political incompetencies around them. The teachers, because they are so deeply committed and invested in children, mm-hmm. they are adapting with us or without us.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So sounds like the trust is there and the agency is there and they're doing good things with it.
Yes.
Mary Catherine, I want to go to you. We're running out of time. We've got to move to questions really fast, but I want to talk to you about the role of the teacher themselves in designing their own learning and designing their professional development. How do we do that? What's the how?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I can connect it back to the hope and despair question you asked as well, because to your point, Vishal, the hope I see is actually where we are incubating promising educational practices because teachers have brought them to us. So to Mr. Lee's point about Education International, so Education International and OECD are right now working on something called Pedagogy Plus. That was, that is a really promising joint project. Locally, with my members at the American Federation of Teachers, we are incubating actually an entire community revitalization project of which public education is a part in McDowell County, West Virginia, called Reconnecting McDowell, where it is intentional to invest in the public school system there and we are investing in the economical situation, the housing situation in the community. We are making sure we're bringing partners from the local government, partners from the small businesses that exist there, so that everyone is invested in McDowell County because they live in McDowell County. And so everyone is, rather than trying to point fingers and blame, everyone comes to the table and says, how do we solve this problem, right? Like, we have low graduation rates. How are we going to all pitch in to solve that problem? We need to attract teachers, but we have no housing for them. How are we all going to pitch in to solve that problem? It's really inspiring. And because they are somewhat removed from that, from that election cycle, essentially, that they will commit to long-term solutions. They will commit to something that may bear fruit in 2 years, in 4 years, in 5 years, because they feel like the investment is long-term. They're not trying to make a headline a month from now, right? They are really trying to, because they're all planning on living in McDowell County, they're going to do that. Peer Assistance and Review is a fascinating story. So Peer Assistance and Review is something that was started in Ohio, in Toledo, Ohio, over 35 years ago. And it was started as a way of, really, as a way of assuring that if someone is job is renewed in their first couple years of teaching, that they deserve it, right? So it was a model to really, like, make sure that if you achieve tenure, you've earned it. Well, since then, it has evolved, and as people heard about Peer Assistance and Review, then Rochester, New York wanted to start a model. Then, in St. Paul, Minnesota, I was able to negotiate a Peer Assistance and Review model using American Reinvestment ARRA funds, that not only started with that initial seed idea that had started 35 years ago, but also said, you know what, our PAR program is going to be full spectrum. Every teacher should be able to take advantage of it, not just to earn tenure, not just to correct if you're stumbling, but if you are a strong teacher who wants to reinvest in yourself, you use PAR to earn your National Board certification, to perhaps shift grade levels, to perhaps add a license. If you want to meet the needs of a new group of students, and so there, like where we have been incubating ideas and then sharing them out, they catch on like wildfire.
So there's this interesting tension we've got here, right, between sort of bottom up and community led and stakeholder led, mm-hmm. and then this what Juho was talking about, this international sort of really taking it even higher level.
The pressure.
I have to go to the audience, or I'm going to. Yeah. So we're going to take a couple questions, and then Juho, I do want to come back to you
I
in
have
the closing.
Another point too.
Yes. Right there. Do we have a microphone, please? Thank you. If you could say your name,
Hello.
Where you're from, and short questions.
Hello.
Very short.
My name is Marcelo Perez Alfaro, and I am from the IDB. I live in Uruguay. Vishal said something that led me to what Rebecca said in the first session. You said that we have to acknowledge that this is a political issue. Rebecca said, which is the demand from leapfrogging? And in Latin America, we see a problem. In every poll that you, in every survey that you made, families ask, I'm happy with this, with the education our kids receive. So if it's not a political issue, if families are not pressuring for leapfrogging, what can we do? In Latin America, we have some experiences of civil society organization advocating for quality right. and equity. By,
so
I want to ask you, what can we do in this scenario?
Where is the demand going to come for change? Juho, why don't you start with that?
I talked about the role of international community. Kind of outsider could be a better innovator, given that insiders tend to be very slow.
Mic has dropped.
So the insiders are slow to make a change. When they are making it slow, then outsiders can step in to spur changes. But I'm not telling that only outsiders should push the change, but you can utilize the outsiders to contribute to the changes. I will talk about one example that that I have made in for vocational schools in Korea. We call Maest High School Initiative. And when we really want to turn around those failing vocational high schools, we invited former CEOs to lead a failing vocational school as a principal. So these former CEOs, with their networks and their experience, they really had a great role to turn around those failing schools. And also, they provide the training opportunities for teachers. They even redesign their curriculums. For example, were providing a major like LED lighting. This is a new technology. How the teachers can teach LED lighting technology? So you ask professionals, engineers in the company to come to school to teach their teachers. So those kind of examples really show that the outsiders can play a very positive and strong role in making a change. So the teachers in those vocational schools are happy now because their schools are being radically upgraded, and their students are getting jobs in good companies. So and they are getting good opportunities to train themselves in the companies. So this is one example how you can leverage those outsiders' innovation to make a change inside.
Yeah, and you mean outsider by not just another country, outsider by another industry, by another outsider in multiple layers of the... Mary Catherine wanted to say one thing, and then I'm going to go to the next question.
Yeah, I would also say, so that's very familiar. It is the Phi Delta Kappa polling, I think, for 30-plus years in the United States, is you grade your own child's schools A or B, and you grade the schools in your community B or C, but schools in general are...
Disaster.
D, yeah. and I think one of the things we need to do first is treat parents like they're right. Right? If you believe that the experience your child is getting is a strong one, then don't accuse a parent of not knowing any better. Like, they must be right, because in 13 years of teaching parent-teacher conferences, I never once met a parent who didn't desperately care about their child. And so the follow-up question is more important. Why do you feel like your child is getting such a great education? And as you start listening to parents explain what they are experiencing, because it's the project-based learning, or because it's the access to world languages, or because it's that teacher who knows my child and really cares, and I feel like they are safe and cared for there, and everyone knows my child's name or whatever, now you have started to create a list of non-negotiable public education experiences every child expects for their, or every parent expects for their own children, which is really the sort of experience we want for all children.
Thank you. Let's go right here, please.
Hi, Joshua Musk in Geneva Global. I'd like to get back to the question that you, the last question that you asked, for which I don't think there was a satisfactory answer. I mean, how do we get teachers helping teachers? And I'm intrigued by the model from mass production to mass personalization that you gave, Juho. You talked learn to test to learn to learn, and the three levels. And I replaced learn with teach. Teach to test, teach to learn, shallow teaching, deep teaching, and then instead of learning, vertical training versus horizontal training. And the you talked about the peer assistance and review.
Yeah.
It seems from most of your language that you were talking about training done to teachers. And I'm used to working in contexts where no one's reaching the teachers. Mountainous Tajikistan, rural Uganda, rural Ethiopia. And what we've been doing a lot of work on there is cultivating education communities of practice so the teachers aren't just sitting there with their arms crossed waiting for someone telling them what to do. So I'd love to hear some more talk about how do we get teachers, not the teacher owning her classroom, but teachers owning their teaching and teachers owning their school so that they're working as a community to cultivate their professional development mutually and the outcomes that they're getting from that. Thank you.
Vicki, let's start with you.
So I actually was going to say when I popped up my hand a moment ago that I actually think that one of the most exciting developments is that teachers aren't waiting for us. That teachers actually are beginning to work with each other to create networks. I mean, sometimes we're helping them create them, but more often than not, they are creating them now themselves because they see this need. And on any piece of research you do about what teachers want, at least in this country, they say they want training that is by teachers for teachers, and that they want to problem solve with other people who they know are in the classroom and have experiences like them. So you could look at anything in this country from teacher to teacher to teaching partners to teaching channel to a whole array of other things, or even on social media where 5 teachers every day reach another 1 million teachers and help them problem solve. There are so many great examples right now of that very thing where I actually think teachers are leapfrogging us in many ways, and that our job is to continue to give power and help that catch fire, and then begin to help them wrap the other kinds of opportunities around it that shift the conditions, help them give voice. I mean, teachers in this country are starting to give voice and shift policy as well. And not just through their unions. As much as they might respect and love their unions, teachers are now starting to do that in their own states and places through their own connections and networks. If you look at Teach Plus or Hope Street Group or other things.
I would say it's fascinating that because teachers are creating this work themselves, and the AFT has a teacher leaders program that essentially creates a cohort of individuals who are solving problems in their districts that the district has not addressed or is unwilling to address or whatever. And when teachers come with ideas, for example, they will create these, whether they are formal cadres or even informal cadres, every teacher knows that the parking lot conversation is sometimes the best professional development they get an entire 8-hour PD day. Because that's where you're really sharing these ideas that excite you. It's when the union brings them to the bargaining table and says, we actually want to institutionalize this idea because it came from teachers, that a district gets really threatened. Like, who do you think you are telling us how to train you? And so that is domestic. When in the situations you're talking about internationally, I think you absolutely hit on sort of this peer assistance and review model, and that is, rather than create a formal structure for the sake of creating a formal structure and have the one principal teacher, right, lead teacher, why wouldn't you have a cadre of peers who say, we acknowledge that you are the strongest math teacher among us, so you're going to mentor us in mathematics, and I'm the strongest writing teacher among us, so I will mentor all of you in writing. That does not mean we are not trading ideas back and forth, but recognizing each other's strengths. Then we are creating models that have no end, then, because we're challenging each other, but we're also leaning on each other, and we're creating a supportive structure as opposed to sort of a hierarchy. And so I think you've touched on the right thing, certainly in whether at a remote or incredibly population dense areas.
It's where technology can play a big role.
Let's take one more question, and then if you've got something on that, we'll come back to it. We also just didn't address the question of time, right? I mean, I think time is an important element in all of this and how you create time for all of that to happen. Back there, the glasses, checkered shirt.
The two people in glasses.
All right.
Oh, I just noticed
that. What are the odds of that?
I know. I feel guilty.
I know.
If you could go really fast, and the other gentleman in checkered shirt.
I'll try to make it quick. So my name is Elia Zulu. I work for the African Institute for Development Policy. It's a policy think tank based in Nairobi. And my question, really, it might end up being a comment. It's more to do with the work we do engaging African leaders across the continent and trying really to understand where they see the big gap in terms of education reforms and so on. And I was very, very pleased to see the example that the gentleman from South Korea talked about, because I've been wondering whether, we as education experts
We are learning enough from international experiences on how to set effective educational systems, and maybe whether we are too fixated with these small experiments that are happening in classes on how to do this, involve the community. I mean, education reforms have been going on for so many years. There are countries, the developed countries, that went through these experiences. There are the emerging countries like South Korea that have done it even during our lifetime. And in terms of now how you help governments like in Africa, look at the scale of the problem. I mean, when South Korea was bringing the Americans in 1960, birth rates were probably around, what, 5, 4? African countries, the populations are going to double in the next 20, 30 years, most of them. The number of people. So the scale of the problem is so huge. And to what extent are we engaging these high-level, macro-level policy processes to help governments set systems that will actually create this enabling environment that will let these small experiments work? I think we are spending too much time on doing small things and not really playing the political game that will enable education be prioritized and go to set up the systems. I mean, the systems for training teachers, I don't think it's a question that is so hard. I think there have been ways that countries have done it. To what extent are we actually learning from this and really dealing with these macro level system issues?
And I do think it's a good point to end on, because I think you're highlighting a central tension, which is this: what do we do from top level, and we've talked a lot about the bottom up and the power of that. What do we do from the top down? I'm going to have to throw that one to Juho. I feel like that's right up your alley.
Yeah, I think we really have to strike a balance between bottom up and top down. I was really struck by one teacher's comment when I was asking why one of my policy has failed to take root. And the teacher said, when ministry is making order, teachers really don't want to follow. So this top-down by minister never works for teachers.
Right.
So I was really surprised to understand that, but that is the kind of sentiment among teachers.
Right.
So we really have to set up a good ecosystem for teachers voluntarily can make a change.
Right.
So how to build an ecosystem which could be very sustainable and also embracing technological changes and also the participation from the communities and so forth. Maybe we have a lot of experience and experiments already, but I don't think any country has been successful in establishing good ecosystem to make a constant change. So so that's why, I mean, this symposium is really timely, I think. And we work together, and maybe we can build a consensus. Then we can try at the international level and at the national level and even at the regional level, and we can make a champion to make a success in building good ecosystem, and then spread those success cases to around the world.
Can I just say also, I think part of getting past the politics actually is diving right into the politics and have the courage to say that this work will not be revenue neutral. We must be done trading, right? It's technology or it's professional development. Like, those are conversations people are actually having, right? It's class size or it's recruiting more diverse teachers. No. Like, actually, if we are going to make progress, progress will not be revenue neutral. And so we have to have the courage to say that.
Right. This is going to be an expensive proposition. Well, it's so much of what you're...
Valuable.
Valuable. A worthy investment.
That's right.
I make one comment. Because this is LeapFrog seminar, I think Korea is the best example of LeapFrog. And what Korea leapfrogged, when Korea leapfrogged, we leveraged the third industrial revolution, the digital technologies. So look at the Korean companies, Samsung and LG. They produce world-class the digital products. Now we are having a fourth industrial revolution, and many developing countries can leverage these new technologies in fourth industrial revolution to leapfrog. Leapfrog in education workforce, leapfrog in economy. could be possible only when these countries can embrace and harness those new technologies.
So it feels like to me we need to go very high level. We need to convince governments that this is a massive priority, this leapfrogging initiative, and then we need to invest in it. We have to acknowledge that it's going to be a very valuable and a long-term outside of the political sphere investment. And then we need to actually use all of that to build up agency sort of bottom up and a lot of trust, a lot of space for the collaboration for the teachers to have power, and the role of technology is critical. That is the only way we're going to get to scale, I think. We have to end.
That was some outstanding synthesizing.
Vishal's going to end our panel for us. And I have a few housekeeping, and you're not allowed to leave until I'm done with it.
I just want to say that while we're looking at it from the space of the fourth industrial revolution, I think we also need to look at it from a space of that we are sitting on an existential question around where are we as a human race heading, and where does the role of empathy and kindness and love play there, and what's the role of education in that? So we don't just look at the economics of it, but really the meaning of life and why do we educate our children?
Amen.
Yes. In Davos, they kept saying, well, the robots are going to do lots of things, so why don't we focus education on the things that the robots can't do? Yeah. And that is all of the skills. They can't do critical thinking particularly well yet, right? They can't do empathy particularly well. They can't support each other and be emotional and connective. So I think that's a great ending point. Okay, thank you very much to all of you. Such an impressive
panel.
We're going to...